Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 40. I'm coming to you from the SAA bunker here in Canberra, and I'm with my colleague, head of research for SAA, Marcus Hellyer. Marcus, how are you?
Good, good. I'm actually calling in from Rome. I had some work to do here. So as you know, there's been an election, not just in Australia, there's one here in Rome as well. And unfortunately, Donald Trump made a few comments about the papal election, saying it'd be great to have an American pope. And I think that kind of maybe crueled the American candidate's hopes. And that coming on top of J.D. Vance's visit to Pope Francis only hours before he died. I'm not saying he caused Pope Francis to shuffle off this mortal coil into a better life, but I don't know. America were a bit on the nose here. Anyway, they called me in. They called me in to do the numbers, to help the American cause. Fortunately, we managed to get Robert Prevost over the line, now Leo the 14th. So,
well, you know, one thing that made me very sad was that he chose as his name Pope Leo the 14th instead of sticking with what the other cardinals call him, which is apparently Bob. I would have loved to see Pope Bob. Would have been fantastic. Yeah. There was a great report from the Batuta Advocate, and I don't know if it was a deep fake or not. It seemed to have some very authoritative sourcing from Vatican security, but it had Pope Leo showing off his Chicagoan upbringing by coming out onto the balcony and celebrating by blasting off with a Glock with an extended magazine in it. That seemed to be...
The guys from Chicago, okay, obviously spent a lot of time in Peru, you know, but he's from Chicago. He speaks great Italian. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think, you know, maybe some deep kind of connections to the Italian community in Chicago. You know, plus he was the guy working for Frankie, ex-pope, who was appointing all of the bishops. He had all the dirt, all of the info on everybody. Is it surprising that he's now pope? If you know everybody's secrets, I don't know. It helps your case. Anyway, like I said, we got Robert over the line. Now, Leo, congratulations.
Well, I tell you what, one exciting election out of two isn't bad, is it? Because I actually found all the black smoke, the mystery. In a way, though, I found the papal election very like our Australian election here in that you couldn't tell what was going on. It was mainly policy and content free. In the Pope's case, it was because they're all inside a locked room and you couldn't see anything. In our case, it was because our major parties had no policies to offer. But there was that same element of secrecy about the policy agenda in both of them.
Well, the good thing about the papal election is that it was mercifully short. The conclave was all done and dusted after 2 days, whereas our policy-free version of an election seemed to drag on and on and on. But anyway, it's again done and dusted and quite a landslide. I mean, I have to say I was surprised. I mean, you know, I'm not the greatest election watcher and political authority in the country, but I don't think I was the only person who was surprised. So at time of recording, Labor has 91 seats, according to the failing ABC News. The Conservatives, the Coalition, only have 40. I mean, that is amazing. That is amazing. And Greens gone from the lower house, probably. That's quite amazing. Though, interestingly, their primary vote doesn't seem to have changed at all. It comes down to preferences. And there's 10 independents of various stripes there. 10 seats still undecided. But, you know, what a remarkable outcome.
Very remarkable. In fact, my view on it is it shows that the coalition, the Liberal National Coalition, did have a political gift. But in this case, it seemed its gift was in making the Labor Party under Mr. Albanese look good. And that was a pretty hard thing to pull off. So full credit to the coalition for making Mr. Albanese look good.
I just got a message in from this guy, Angus Taylor. Do you know him? I don't know, but he wants me to do some numbers for him based on my recent success. So
based on your work for Chicago Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see where that goes. But if we sort of zoom in on the defense aspects of the election, and we kind of have to zoom in a really long way because the defense aspects of our recent election were pretty microscopic.
I think we need some of those long photo lenses you use for bird watching, Marcus, to be able to zoom in enough to see something interesting about the defense aspects of this
election. Yeah, I think you do need some assistance. The government essentially ran on its record, which was the National Defence Strategy. You know, it's here's the plan. Though I will say that the defence minister, also known as the deputy prime minister, did sort of hint that he thought his work was done. His mission accomplished and he was ready to move on to something else. I'm not sure what he wants to move on to. I'd be looking for a promotion. I don't know what promotion from deputy prime minister is since the top job is occupied. So maybe we need to invent another title. Vice prime minister, maybe?
Maybe principal deputy prime minister, or maybe take something out of Rome, not so much from the Pope, but what about Pontifex Maximus, a title from ancient Rome? I think that Pontifex Maximus and defence minister.
Well, I certainly agree. Deputy prime minister is not quite pompous enough at this point.
No, so. No.
Will he remain defence minister? I'm not sure. As deputy prime minister or soon to be Pontifex Maximus, he does get to pick his own portfolio. I mean, I think he'd love to be foreign minister, but again, there's an occupant there.
I would say he notionally gets to pick his portfolio unless he wants to take pennies.
Yes. Considering it was Penny Wong who introduced Albo to the stage on election night, I think there is a fairly close bond there that could be hard for Richard Miles to shake.
Anyway, look, I think the tagline on defence after the election is careful continuity. If you've loved what you've seen for the last 3 years, you're going to love the next 3 years just as much.
I think it will be steady as she goes. Though getting back to the election campaign, the one new thing was right at the death, sort of barely a week before actual polling day, as we're getting our democracy sausages, the coalition sort of incrementally put out its defence policy with not so many details, a few interesting details in it. The core of it was saying they would get to 2.5% of GDP in 5 years' time and 3% in 10 years' time, which sort of budged the government a microscopic amount, where Albo, in response to that, said, well, he was willing to consider increases to the defence budget. But that was about the sum total.
I didn't even really get that as a future promise. I took that as like a political immunization program. You know, if I say I'm open-minded on it, then I maybe sound like I've neutralized the opposition's promise to increase the budget. I think that was just to get him through the campaign. I don't think there was anything behind that. Of course, how he then has a discussion with our big, fairly crazy American ally about the defense budget is interesting, because I don't think that kind of flim-flam will work quite so well.
No, well, considering that Albo has, since the election, said that he's lined up conversations with Donald Trump, one suspects that, you know, that could be an issue for discussion.
Yeah, well, I kind of hope it is. I kind of hope it is, frankly.
But bottom line, steady as she goes. So, yeah, if you like the last 3 years, it'll be more of the same. Nothing that has happened, you know, in Washington, in the South China Sea, anywhere in Ukraine, has fundamentally shifted sort of Labour's political leadership in thinking that the world is a more dangerous place. Because I'm not sure how you can think the world is a more dangerous place and have a more unreliable United States and yet do nothing to change your underlying defence plan.
Your settings and directions. Well, I have an answer to that, because on the Sunday morning I was driving up to take my son to an indoor cricket game up in Sydney. And that Sunday morning, straight after the election, you could barely see on the freeway between Canberra and Sydney. And that's because there were enormous clouds of what I originally thought was fog, but it turned out it was great clouds of smug. There was smug all over the place. And I think it was a combination of smug from the re-elected Labor government and also smug produced by the Canberra bureaucracy that felt really happy that with this careful continuity where nothing changes, they've got a very easy life for the next 3 years. So enormous clouds of smug were covering great swathes of this great Australian countryside.
Yeah, so I think on AUKUS, there will be no change on AUKUS. We will continue with AUKUS. I think both of the major parties, not that the conservative side of the major parties will have much of a, will matter that much in Parliament, certainly in the lower house, but this idea of a inquiry into AUKUS.
Well, this is where I was going to go. You know, we talk about careful continuity, nothing's going to change. That's true at the political level. No one in either of the major parties, particularly the ruling government, wants to change anything about AUKUS or defence. Mm-hmm. But if you look at polling, The Australia Institute did a poll at the end of last year and then late April again, and they asked Australians, did they want a more independent foreign policy? It was 44% of Australians wanted that at the end of 2024. Just before the election, 29th of April, it was up to 54%, so a 10% increase. And interestingly, in that same poll, Australians were asked, what do you think about AUKUS? 48% of them said they thought AUKUS would make Australia safer. But 56% of Australians said there should be a parliamentary inquiry into AUKUS. And that tells me the public support is really soft for AUKUS. And it's up to our political leaders to carry the public argument for AUKUS, because if they don't, it's not sustainable public policy.
Well, and they haven't really attempted to make the case for AUKUS other than somehow SSNs are much better than conventionally powered submarines. That's essentially the extent of it, and the usual jobs and growth fluff about thousands of jobs.
But in the absence of detail about how it's progressing, openness about the challenges, and strong public policy leadership, Australians are getting more sceptical about it. So I think that's a political challenge for the next 3 years.
Sceptism at the moment, that big rise in sceptism, obviously is related to the return of Donald Trump to the presidency. So it's not sceptism about AUKUS per se, it's sceptism, I think, about the alliance and ANZUS. So AUKUS is simply a subset of the alliance and ANZUS. So if you're sceptical about the alliance, then you're going to be sceptical about AUKUS. But interestingly, it's I think not just the public who are getting a little sceptical about aspects of AUKUS. I recently read this report out of the CSBA, so Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, one of the sort of hardcore US beltway think tanks dealing specifically with defense and security matters. Mm-hmm. They ran some workshops earlier in the year and they published the results. And it was one of those classic exercises of trade-offs. Okay, you haven't got any more money, but you want to achieve certain ends. So what are you going to give up so you can increase investment? And the task they set was an Australian-sponsored one, and that is, how does Australia conduct long-range strike in a hypothetical scenario where you're trying to take out Chinese military facilities in the South China Sea? So, again, it's another interesting piece that the defense seems to have become very concerned about Chinese long-range missiles in targeting Australia from the South China Sea. So this is another, I think...
I would say they can target us from closer to home, given what they did just a little while ago. But anyway, the scenario was South China Sea, and what strike capabilities has Australia got?
Defence is quite concerned about that. And so obviously, if that's the exercise, then you trade off a lot of army so you can get longer range strike. But to me, one of the really interesting things in it is that so there were six different groups, six different teams. I think three in America, three in Canberra, I believe. Four of them said, we need to dump Snorkers. So we need to dump SSN AUKUS. But they didn't say dump AUKUS completely. We should get Virginia-class submarines instead of SSN AUKUS. And that's driven around the schedule risks around SSN AUKUS. And that's kind of interesting because this is a topic we've talked about before. Like, why under the so-called AUKUS optimal pathway are we going to all the trouble of designing and building a British nuclear submarine after we've introduced into service the US Virginia-class submarine? Why not just keep getting more Virginias? So interestingly, these people reach the same conclusion.
Sure, but isn't there a problem with that? Because I thought the scenarios were about long-range strike by Australia in some kind of time frame between now and 2035. And Snorkers doesn't start to appear until well beyond that time frame. So it's kind of it's irrelevant to the work.
The irony is, of course, is that no SSNs help you at all, because if you're trying to conduct long-range strike in the first half of the 20s, SSNs just don't help you at all, because best case, you might have two by the mid-2030s and two firing off a handful of Tomahawk missiles does nothing to help you. Interestingly, the only option that really did help you was our old friend Plan B, i.e. the B-21 bomber. So more JSFs don't really help you. They don't have the range. They can't deliver some significant amounts of ordnance. More P-8 maritime patrol aircraft don't really help you because they can't deliver enough ordnance. The one thing that really helps you in that scenario is B-21. However, because the ground rules were there's no more money. You can't give, if you want to keep your SSNs, you can't free up enough cash to get B21s if the overall pot doesn't increase. So the one thing that can really help you is kind of taken off the table. So,
but isn't that just a wholly
exercise?
Isn't that just a wholly artificial exercise with artificial constraints then? So if you were looking at the problem, you would think, well, I need credible long-range strike, and the only thing giving that to me in this time frame is the B21. You may even then start to say, well, so what am I doing with this AUKUS thing? But anyway, it's interesting that even closed groups of experts, when they're looking at problems, solutions like the B21 come out, but then they self-constrain themselves so that they can't propose it. I think that's one of the most interesting things about this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that one plus the view of four of the six groups that Snorkus just has way too much risk around it. So let's just stick with Virginia's. Now, I would also think that there's a lot of risk around that as well.
Yeah, well, look, hopefully we'll know a lot more about how the Australian Submarine Agency is going shortly, because the Deputy Prime Minister, Richard Miles, commissioned former Defence Secretary and all-round luminary Dennis Richardson to do a review of the Submarine Agency.
All right, so pick a number between 1 and 100 indicating your confidence that review will ever see the light of day.
Is the number 0 in that range? Because I think based on Mr. Richardson's track record and his known antipathy towards freedom of information, I don't think we will see that report. And at best, we'll get some press statement from the minister. It's probably Richard Miles or Pat Gomroy. And we'll be told there's a lot of cabinet incompetence, commercial incompetence stuff. But really, back to this point about the public needing to understand AUKUS better, releasing a report like this would start to build that public confidence. Even if it's got negative stuff, it would show some honesty and it would show maybe the government wants to do something about problems. So very healthy if they release that. In that report, I hope they cover how much has been spent by the Submarine Agency on various top-end-of-town consultancies, because looking at the menu of big consultancies that have got contracts with the Submarine Agency, I can't see a high-priced consultancy missing out. They've got McKinsey, they've got EY, they've got Boston Consulting, they've got KPMG, and they've even got Deloitte. And I think the McKinsey one is something like $9.5 million for 10 months' work. So, and shout out to McKinsey here for giving $500,000 discount on their usual $1 million a month fee for these kind of services.
Well, you should be grateful, Michael. No, I would love to know how the Australian Submarine Agency and the SSN Enterprise is managing to spend $3.5 billion next financial year. Because you look at it and you go, all right, yes, we do have the Pontifex Maximus or the Deputy Vice Prime Minister carrying bags of cash over to the US and UK. But when you look at how that's structured, that doesn't come close to $3.5 billion, I think, next year. The amount of infrastructure work that's being done so far is pretty minimal because we haven't started the really big work around building the construction shipyard. We haven't started doing the big dry docks that will do the deep maintenance.
The maintenance over in the west, yep. Well, all we're doing is some modifications and extensions at HMAS Stirling, I think, to accommodate some visiting submarines.
Yeah, so it's stuff to support the SURF West, so Submarine Rotational Force West, but the government has already said that the deep maintenance for those boats will be done back in their home country, so it's not big infrastructure there. Okay, we're training some submariners, and there is an FMS case that has been established for that. But you know, I really struggle to work out where we're spending $3.5 billion in next year on the Submarine Enterprise. So
yeah, I agree with you.
A line item breakdown there.
Even these top end of global consultancies like Boston Consulting and McKinsey's, they just can't be charging enough to get close to the $3.5 billion. So there's a mystery there.
I think they'd like to charge enough to get close to $3.5 billion.
Yeah. So look, let's hope there's some transparency about this review. It'll be lovely to see that. It'll be a great way for the government to start this next term of government. And also, I think it'd show confidence from the government. They've got a big fat majority here. Maybe they can do something. Remember John Howard, he used to talk about scraping off the barnacles. You know, you get rid of some of the standing problems you've carried with you and start afresh, more transparency about where all these billions of dollars are going, not just in defense, but across the board, would be very healthy.
Well, I love your optimism, young man, but even if there were a review, my sense is it would not be a completely open review about what AUKUS is, what it's actually trying to deliver, the risks around it. It would be more like the review that the UK recently commissioned, which was really about, are we getting maximum benefit out of it, essentially, which is code for, are we getting enough money from the Australians? How do we maximise what we're getting out of the Australians?
Well, I think we can assure the UK Parliament that it's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, an analogy I've used before is, for the UK, we Australians are like, you know, their submarine enterprise was like a falling down manor house on a big estate. And the great news was their third son had travelled to Australia on a holiday, calls home, and he's in love with an Australian girl. They're horrified.
Yeah, until who owns, you know, 500,000 acres and, you know, 500,000 sheep and is, you know, riding high on the sheep's back and is going to save the old family back in Yorkshire or whatever.
Yeah, so we're the sort of angel investor or the wealthy sort of colonial wife that is then going to fund the repairing of the West Wing of the family home. That's right.
But that's kind of the answer to the question of why won't there be a review here? Because if you did a review here, you would say that virtually the benefits flow in one direction.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it going to lead to this amazing, you know, all this stuff about somehow AUKUS will revitalize high-tech manufacturing in Australia and there'll be all of these technical spin-offs? I mean, it is all delusional.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to talk much about Donald Trump here, but I do think we've just seen the US-UK trade deal. It's not really a deal. It's an abstract sketch about what a deal might be, but it's got some very small beer in it. But if our Prime Minister meets with Donald Trump, I think the one thing we won't hear them say is about the seamless integration of the Australian and American defence industrial bases so that everything that Australia does can be sold directly into America for defence purposes. I just don't think we're going to hear that.
It is not a Trumpian announceable. It is not a deal if he says, guess what, the US is buying military technology from Australia. That is the last kind of announceable he wants.
No. What Starmer ended up having to do was promise that UK airlines were going to buy a whole lot of Boeing planes, in exchange for which Rolls-Royce was going to be able to sell some engines. And he managed to stand up and resist Trump's call to let chlorinated chicken come into the UK market. So
this amazing deal is actually saying we're going back to where we were before Trump announced the whole tariff thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but
except you have that underlying, the 10% baseline is still there for
that's
everything.
That's still there.
It's not one of the things. You know, yeah. And we're going to see deals like this ad nauseum as countries come along and you pull out one or two things here that as an announceable, but the underlying tariff structure, I think, is roughly going to stay where it is.
Well, also, I think all of that stuff about 46% tariffs, 25% tariffs, Liberation Day, this is all falling into a pattern now with the Trump administration. You know, Trump 2.0 is really an elephant who's giving birth to a series of mice. It's just all very underwhelming when from the sort of hysterical high point of announcements to delivery. And that's true whether it's all this trade deal stuff or whether it's, say, DOGE. You know, it starts with a bang, ends with a whimper, and that's the pattern that we're seeing, which brings me straight to the hoodies. Starts with a bang, ends with a whimper.
I will just say one thing, though, on your where Trump is delivering is in the destruction of US democracy. It is in the establishment of autocracy. So it is in the, you know, undermining of the rule of law. It is in the shameless self-enrichment through various Bitcoin and online currencies. It is the war on legal firms that have represented Trump's opponents. It's the war on universities, you know. So Trump is actually making a lot of progress in that regard. So my deep pessimism around the future of democracy in the US has not been assuaged at all by his absolute incompetence in other areas such as trade policy.
Look, I think you're right that the domestic impact of the Trump administration is enormous and damaging. And I think I'm not downplaying the effect internationally. I'm just saying you go from the aspiration that you hear from the Trump administration and then the reality, and there's a massive gap. And it's all performative politics. So now there'll be these historic deals that are celebrated. But when you look at them, they're deeply underwhelming. It's performative politics.
Well, one of those performative areas was the Secretary of the Army just put out a letter to the Army leadership. And the terminology doesn't even make sense. So, for example, it says that they're going to cease procuring Model D Apache attack helicopters. It's like, well, they haven't actually procured any of them for years. They've been built and delivered years ago. What they seem to be saying is they're going to actually retire them. They're going to stop operating their older attack helicopters. And the context there, of course, is the drone threat and the threat to crewed systems. And I sort of agree with that sentiment, but it's just not expressed in accurately or in kind of terminology that, you know, you really understand what they're doing. So I've spoken to various people and the consensus does seem to be they're going to retire, you know, most of their Apache helicopters, including all of the older ones. But that's mm-hmm. not what the letter actually says. There's a lack of basic competence in the Pentagon at the moment.
Yeah, well, one effect, I think, is even when they try to do something good, how they do it brings the idea into disrepute. So the Secretary Hegseth one-page memo about cutting 20% of star rank officers, there's no... I want to get to this structure. So, you know, transition from what you got to this structure. But there's no guidance about what functions are more important. It's just over to you, make me happy. And you just think you're going to get this random walk mess out of that. And it just looks, and I think is, just an unprofessional way to lead and manage large institutions.
Well, I don't think anyone would ever accuse Pete Hegseth of excessive professionalism.
Yeah, so again, it's performative. I think it's performative. And there are people that say, oh, that's fantastic. He's downsizing the military hierarchy. Yeah, but how you do it and how it looks at the end matters a lot. It's always, you know, the vision is the easy thing. The implementation is the hard thing. And that's where this giant gap is.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that term, performative. And Elon Musk and Doge is kind of the living evidence of that, where after a few months, he's sort of given up and gone home because it's actually really difficult to cut government spending in a coherent way. You know, once you sort of do a few flashy things at the start, it's actually a slow, hard grind.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hard grinds, we're getting towards the end of the podcast here. I did want to just talk about the Houthis in America and just some simple facts about that operation. So we heard this week that the USS Truman, the aircraft carrier that's been sort of in the middle of these counter Houthi operations, has lost its third Super Hornet now. Yeah, so lost one to friendly fire. Another one fell off the elevator. And this last one has gone off the end because the arrestor system failed when it landed. None of that, I'm not saying any of that is sort of, you know, some disastrous mismanagement. I think to me, it just proves the point that when you get into a conflict, you suffer losses. You lose some of your important systems. And the lesson out of that to me is you need to be able to replace them. You can't have such a small force and that you can't replace it. And it can't be stuff that takes so long, you can't replace it even if you want to. So, you know, even the Americans fighting the Houthis have been losing aircraft. And of course, they've lost some of their expensive drones as well.
Well, yes, I'd certainly agree with that point. My understanding is on the shoot down, there was a serious lack of competence going on there and a serious lack of training and preparedness of the vessel that did the shoot down. So there are some reports on that suggesting that it was quite badly done. On the aircraft falling off the aircraft carrier, I have heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, is that the carrier actually was making some dramatic evasive maneuvers to avoid an incoming Houthi missile, and that's what caused it to fall off. I don't know if it's true, but yeah, you know, there you go. There's, you know, several hundred million dollars worth of aircraft that have been lost, and that's on top of a couple of hundred very expensive air defense missiles like SM-2s and SM-6 that, you know, go at several million dollars a pop. So war is a very expensive business. And as you say, you need deep magazines of weapons that you can replace, which is my segue into my little update on drones. And so I have a connection with a company that makes undersea drones, so I'm very interested in maritime drones. Now, one of the things we're seeing in the Black Sea is we've sort of reached the point where if you can imagine an effect, you can now actually do it for real.
Well, how about surface drones killing major warships? Can that happen?
Well, that happened. That's old news now. That is ancient history. You know, Russian ships don't even essentially take to the waters in the Black Sea anymore because so many have been sunk by kamikaze drones there. So now,
well, how about drones and missiles killing submarines in their home ports or dry docks? Can that happen?
It could happen. I think what has actually happened, it was a traditional kind of strike missile that took out the Russian submarines. But what has happened is that surface drones carrying anti-aircraft missiles have shot down helicopters, and it seems to be that they've now shot down fighter jets. So these little cheap drones just carrying an air-to-air missile, essentially just on a stick, has shot down fighter planes. And also these cheap drones carrying land strike missiles have taken out ground-based air defense systems on the shore of the Black Sea. So all of these things that a few years ago you'd go, well, particularly if you're in the Australian Defense Department, you go, oh yeah, but you can't do that. Like, the legal issues are too complex. The command and control is too complex. What happens if, you know, the communication links are severed? It's just not going to happen. Don't even bother thinking about that. That's why you need Apache helicopters.
Well, I like the other argument, the smarter ones that still want to keep their old plan. Their line is, look, all those things are credible sometime in the future, but that future's still a long way away.
Well,
I think that that's not true. These things, as you say, are happening now.
The future is here. What is really interesting is how people don't want to accept that, and the arguments they come up with to sort of say that's not happening. You know, and of course, we've talked about the favorite one of defense is that, well, that's fine in Ukraine and the Black Sea because it's really, really small, but the Indo-Pacific is big, really huge. It's not going to work here. There's no difference, really. I mean, distance is not the key discriminator here. As we see, you know, modern propulsion systems, you know, satellite communication systems, it's going to happen here.
Well, the thing about what the Ukrainians have just been doing is they've been using one platform to get the weapon into range. So if you've got a longer range vessel that you've got these lethal systems on, distance isn't the problem. You just have to be able to get the weapon within range, which is actually exactly what happens with things like traditional fighter aircraft. They have to get the aircraft to get close enough to get the air-to-air missile or land strike missile in range. So this is the same thing we're seeing in the uncrewed world.
And fortunately, the US Defense Department seems to get this, unlike our Defense Department. So the US, the DIU, so the Defense Innovation Unit over there, put out an expression of interest for a undersea drone that can carry payloads of particular sizes. Well, the big payload bears a very striking similarity to a Mark 48 torpedo. The diameter, the length. So they just want cheap and cheerful drones that can take their expensive munition closer without having to rely on, guess what, SSNs. Because the SSN is simply a delivery system for the Mark 48 torpedo. If you can get rid of the $5 billion SSN and do it with a drone that costs $1 million or $2 million, why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. So that's true. I think those drone developments, I think even the US Apache direction, they're not going to operate their new Apache E's by themselves. They're going to wrap them up with uncrewed systems, particularly the Grey Eagle. So the slower moving US Army is learning lessons that our military are still refusing to do.
Yeah, except we are still getting Apache for about $5 billion, but not the UAVs to go with it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose let's end on a wonderful note of success. Donald Trump has declared victory over the Houthis. They've ended a ceasefire, and he's claimed it's because of the phenomenal success in the US military strikes. The only thing that makes me think that perhaps isn't true is the Houthis have also claimed victory and have faced down the big US Navy. And it's a win-win.
Then didn't the next day the Houthis then redirect their attention to Israel and
strike? The day Donald Trump said the Houthis are no longer going to attack international shipping, the Houthis had attacked Israel's central airport, Ben Gurion Airport. Hmm. So I'm not sure Mr. Netanyahu is quite so comfortable with the support he's getting from Donald Trump with this trusting the Houthis to keep their word. And also, back to performative politics, I'm not seeing international shipping piling back into the Red Sea and the areas the Houthis were threatening. I think they want to see whether this is real or just another announcement. Yeah. Well, Marcus, great to see you. When are you flying out of the Vatican? When do you come back?
Any day now. Any day now. I've, you know, just been looking at some of the sites, and I'll get back. By the time I get back, we'll probably have a defense minister. I don't know who it will be, but I'm sure that will be decided.
I will share with you and whoever stayed with us to this point what I've heard about the review of the coalition's election campaign and policy platform. The rumors are that the two people that are being appointed to run that review are Elon Musk and Mr. Farage from the UK. So I think they'll bring a whole set of fresh eyes to this, and I think they can probably make Australia great again. It's good to see. That's a kind of AUKUS-y thing too, isn't it? An American with Mr. Musk, a UK guy, and Farage helping us out down here.
Well, I don't know. Like I said, I'm not the world's biggest expert on Australian electoral politics, but a dramatic shift to the right may not be what the Australian electorate is looking for in the Liberal Party at the moment. But hey, what do I know?
Yeah, I think that would be a message I was taking out of it too, Marcus. Yep. Okay, good to talk with you.
All right. Okay. Bye.
See you.